I'm Liz Santoro. I'm a dance choreographer, originally from New York, but I live in Meekbourg here in Paris. I originally come to dance choreography from classical ballet. I tried to stop dancing for a while, and I got a degree in neuroscience from Harvard University. And then I started to, while I was in school, make some dance experiments with composition of bodies, and eventually made my way to start working with some dance contemporary choreographers. And when I started to make my own work, I was asking about the question of what is created by attention. Attention, yes. Attention. Am I going at an okay tempo? Okay. Thank you.
Speak, easy. Hear you there.
It's like, Mom, is that you? No, sorry. what was I going to say? The first question I asked when I started making work is, what would actually happen if one was on stage without any choreography, without any text, without any kind of score, improvisation or otherwise? What would actually happen? Was postulating that in fact the receiving of a gaze is actually going to create a dance within itself in the body, the shifts in the nervous system, chemical reactions. Obviously, my nervous system right now is doing something very different than it did 5 minutes ago when I was either sitting or doing the activity with you. I'm in a different state because I'm receiving your attention. I actually made my first piece using this, what we call triangle practice, so what I just described, where there is no choreography, there is no text. We did an entire piece, pretty much, where we did that. And in fact, in the research, I was really excited because we came across the Botox research that you were talking about. We were working a lot on that with this idea of empathy and what is exchanged in receiving this attention, and that was something that came up a lot in our work. Since 2013, I've been co-authoring pieces with a theater maker named Pierre Godard. We have a company called Le Principe d'Incertitude. Le Principe d'Incertitude, or the Uncertainty Principle. Pierre is actually, as I speak, he's in another CNRS called LIMSI in Orsay, doing a PhD in natural language processing. So it's a bit of a bummer that Jeremy disappeared. It was Jeremy that was here earlier this morning. Jeremy? Yeah. I had some questions for him. And in working together with him, with Pierre, we started to look at points of contact between movement and text. So it was a different way to be looking at language. And so it was introducing a lot of different tools, like also I was wanting to ask Jeremy about this, but the last piece we made, a piece called Maps. Maps, like plan, yeah. But plural, yeah. We took the semantic map that's in our cortex, and we put it in actual space to work inside of. I was going to have a quick video. It's possible to show that in a second, just to give some concrete images behind what I'm talking about. But the last three pieces we've made for a theater space, a more traditional theater space. We also have made several site-specific pieces in museums, things like this. But the last three pieces we made are working at this idea of points of contact between text and movement. Just in a second. I'll explain so that then it's clear what the video. The first piece is called Relative Collider, and the name will be on the screen. And we had a movement structure that was fixed and gave birth to a text structure. And that text is generated in real time, randomly, during the performance. So you'll see it's the first clip. Everything's very quick. So Won't get bored, I promise. And there'll see a speaker on stage, and he's speaking a text. He's just saying random words or words that are generated on his computer screen using Gutenberg.org, Gutenberg Project, which is all the open source text material that exists, at least in English, that have the same structure that the dance structure has, in the sense that they're the word "and" is in the same place for the movement as it is for the text. So, in a very simple way of dance movement, when you repeat a leg, you have a ball change. You say in French, you say a contretemps. Contretemps. Yeah. Sorry. So you would say like one. No, it's not syncope. I get stuck between French and English in this moment. So it's like 1, 2, 3, and 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. 1, 2, and 3. So these ands that we're using in our body, we're then showing up. We use them as a structure for the text that's getting created in real time. And then the second piece, for Claude Shannon, which we just performed last week, reversed this question. So we had a fixed text structure. And using a dependency analysis program from this natural language processing research that Pierre's doing, we have a movement and a music structure that gets created and gets generated every time the performance gets done, just before the audience enters the space. So the choreography is never fixed, and nobody knows it, and I couldn't do it for you right now unless I spent 45 minutes getting a generated key that then gives me those cues, which part of that interest in that tool is something that interests me about what you're talking about, François, of this idea of predictability and how can we actually predict what someone's going to do. We're actually, in our work, trying to either remove that capacity of an audience to see, or displace it completely. Should I shut up? No, and just quickly, and then the last piece that you'll see, this piece called Maps that I just mentioned, about a semantic map in space. You can show the video, and then have I spoken enough? Yeah? You're not counting. I can talk. Maybe you can show it if you want.
Over and next, Pearson, Barney, Boot, and Peter, Jones, and Sam, DeLong, and Jack, Dare, Browns, and Join the Army, and then away out. Hopes and hopes and fears, tears and smiles and tears, cheers and pulled for meat and wine, and they ate and drunk and were gold and brown and brown and gold.
You were talking. I was interested in you were talking at the very end, and I thought you sort of had to maybe chop off the end of what you were going to say. So, but I was wanting to hear more because you were saying about this that perceived direct gaze can introduce a positive appraisal of others. So, and as a performer and making this work and sort of what I'm interested in And what I said about what can be created by receiving the attention, receiving gaze, is actually not always I don't want to say a negative thing, but it can also be something that introduces stress, anxiety, or also can shift your capacity to focus. For example, in the second piece, in the Four Claude Shannon piece, where the choreography is learned just before, it took us a really something that Chloe was saying this morning is like that we're working to make the piece, and then it's not actually until the audience is in the space, because we're working very much on them, on you, on the side, spectators creating the show. So we often say that the first performance is actually like our first répétition, our first rehearsal. So actually, in that piece for Collision in particular, a lot of the work in general, it actually takes a while. The piece needs to tour a bit or needs to perform somewhat before we can actually start to receive that direct gaze, because otherwise it has a tremendous impact where at the point you lose completely what you're doing. I mean, it wipes away the choreography that you're already working hard to try to hold on to because you just learned it. And then, this is not a question, but just something else I was very excited about to hear what you're saying in the end, because I think there's something very fundamental in what I understand is very, or what I feel is personally very, the reason why I see shows or I see performance or I participate in the métier that I do is I feel like the reason that I go and I'm going to look and I'm going to watch a show, I'm going to be a spectator, is I'm going to see someone else or see something else, see other people, so that I can actually just get more information about myself. And I was feeling like it was very beautiful that I could take your research and start to hold it in this other space in terms of what I'm looking at. But anyway, that's it.
Okay, perfect. So I'm Alexandre Couty. I work on psychology, cognitive psychology, and most of my research interests are rooted in the issue, in action. According to this kind of approach, every knowledge emerges from the body as a result of its interaction with the environment. So, in this framework, you can have different perception of the environment, especially from the space. Space, in this kind of approach, can be conceived as the sensory motor construction that results from all our interactions with the objects that are in the space. For example, a glass or someone else. So in this space, when an object is presented to me, it is interesting to consider that several authors show that this object potentialize, activate a specific action toward this object. For instance, when someone presents a glass, grasping of this glass is activated. All the sensory motor networks in my brain are activated. But reciprocally, when I plan to act on a specific object in my environment, for instance, this glass or a pen, the simple fact of planning this action will orient my attention toward this object. So there are as many ways to orient my attention in the space towards the different objects that are in the space, that they have opportunities to act on these objects. It can be an eye movement, a gaze movement, or a movement of my whole body, or maybe just specifically the movement of my hand. So, we have in this conception a kind of loop in which what I planned to act will orient my attention toward the object. And in return, when I perceive, when I feel something in my environment, it will activate an action toward this object. You can hear me still, or?
Yes.
Okay? Okay, good. So, my whole environment and the space is constructed with all these actions. In a more ecological example is the experiment of High and Elf in the 60s, in which there was a little carousel with two groups of cats. One cat could actively explore the environment, whereas the other group of cats was in the carousel and couldn't move. They explored passively this space and all the objects that were in this environment. What is interesting in this experiment is that only the cats who actively explored the environment by walking in it could efficiently interact with the object. So all these ideas are interesting to articulate with a specific approach in embodiment, the ideomotriz theory. In this theory, action and perception are seen as the both sides of the same coin. But what structures this link, this relationship, is the anticipation of the consequences of action. So, when I perceive something, when I see an object, this activates an action on that is relevant for this object, but I also anticipate all the emotional consequences of this action. Emotional, perceptive, visual, auditive, all the consequences that that accompany this action. So, this general context is interesting to articulate with the two previous presentations of Laurence Conti and François Kesque, because the social context in which the action is done is always there, and this social context will structure this action. It will structure the aim of the action, because I have to do something because I anticipate the social consequences of this action. But this social context also structures the representation of my action, because most of the time I don't act alone. I act with people that do the same thing in cooperation or in competition with me. so that the action is not something neutral with the social context. I will represent my action differently. I will plan it differently according to when I do it in cooperation, in coaction, or in competition with someone else. So that leads to the following question. Can the social dimension be conceived as a factor that will modulate the basic cognitive processing and thus my understanding of my environment, or is social dimension, does it structure the basic cognitive functioning? This question, according to me, is really important to understand how to articulate this different level of description and of heuristic of our construction of space. Thank you very much.
Merci, Alexandre. Oui, oui, super. Je te laisse ça sur... comme ça, tu peux nous entendre.
Oui,
c'était compréhensible. Oui, même traduit en langue des signes internationale. C'était fascinant, incroyable.
C'est génial, parce que moi, j'avais que l'écho de ma voix, c'était horrible.
je vous laisse, un des deux, faire un petit retour.
T'as tendu le bras, je te laisse.
Thank you. I will start to respond to your question, and I will relate it to another question that had been asked. I don't know, maybe it's you. Someone asked, can we distinguish between being looked at and reciprocal gaze? It was you, so I think this is a fun...
Yes, speak more.
More, okay, this is better, sorry. So Azaf asked whether we should distinguish between being looked at and reciprocal gaze. And
perceived a belief of being watched by another.
Where?
In one of your slides it said belief of
In fact, the work I presented essentially talk about reciprocal gaze, eye contact in a dyadic interaction. Mm. And I think this is very different from the audience effects that are also studied in the literature. And I think what you refer for in your presentation was more like audience effect.
It's the basis of my question is coming from that, because that's my life, but it's also my work is also trying to understand outside of a stage context as well. Like even right now, I make contact with you, and we're I'm extrapolating it beyond stage was my question. If there's other ways in which it's you find other sorts of impact that you were listing.
Okay, so should I continue on your question? And in my knowledge, the two situations has never been directly compared. So being looked at and creating eye contact per se. But there are situations where these two stimulus could have the same impact. For example, activating pro-social action, creating eye contact between two individuals, or being looked at by a public, activates pro-social actions in both cases. And there are other situations. For example, we talk about that during the break. Like I present you this troop task, where people have to determine the color of the words. And when you present a gaze looking at you in photograph, this interferes with your task. But there are also other works showing that if someone is looking at you during the task, but is in the room, not directly in your focus of attention, in this case, the interference totally disappeared, even the interference of the world. So if you can have two kind of effect on your performance in the case of eye contact and in the case of being looked by someone. Okay. So I think that this work comparing the two situations should be run, but that did not exist yet. Someone has, and to respond to Alexandre, I don't know whether he
yeah.
Sorry. Are you here, Alexandre?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Do you hear me?
Well.
Right. So I think you already have the response of your question, but I will give this response. There are some authors, several authors, defend the view that the default mode of the brain is a social mode. So it has been demonstrated that when you are at rest, you have a network of brain regions that are activated and are synchronized together. So when you are at rest, your brain is activated. And those regions, most of them, are involved in social cognition. So there are this theory that the default mode of the brain is social. So the social context will not modulate the cognitive processing, but will basically how do you say that, Alexandre? Would basically structure the cognitive functioning. So, but this needs experimental evidence. And for example, the theory of experiment I show you on the effect of social contact on the effect of social contact on interoceptive awareness. We recently tested whether this effect could emerge from an effect of the social contact on this default mode network that I evoked. So that social contact could increase the synchronization of the default mode network and increase self-awareness and self-focused attention. And for the other question you asked me, someone asked whether studies have been run on contemplating gaze, contemplative. Gaze.
Contemplative
gaze. I don't think so. This is an interesting question, but I have no example in mind. Someone else asked whether the N170 was localized in the fusiform gyrus, which is also an area known to process word, involved in word processing.
Can you say that again?
Sorry. So the N170 could be localized in the fusiform gyrus. And this region is also known to process words. So the interference in the stroop task could be related to this region. In fact, it cannot be because it is not exactly the same region of the brain. It is located in the temporal lobe. It is very closed, but it is not the same region. And the N170 is probably generated by the fusiform gyrus, yet the modulation on the N170 probably emerged from other neurons' population. The N170 itself would be generated by the fusiform gyrus, but the modulation may come from other brain regions. And I show you that the modulation we found in your different studies come from other regions of the brain, not from the fusiform gyrus. Oh, sorry.
This was my question, and it was a bit different. You want to? Next. Be precise. So the question actually came less from the question of modulation, even though it's an interesting follow-up, but just for the fact that relating it to eye, to looking at eyes rather than whole faces, and then giving it some kind of a social interpretation, because in my interpretation of the N170 Meg for words and faces, and some of the results that Dehan et al. Have with people who cannot read, with illiterates, it seems to actually be so a left-right distinction, right? So there's more left is more words, right is faces in the fusiform. But the idea I understood that it had to do something with gestalt perception of some form, so, right? Yes, and so and I always thought that was why words and faces share the same region in the brain and a similar time course. My question is, given the very interesting evidence and interpretation of this M170 is having to do, to start with eyes and not anything about, and maybe some social interpretation, how do we then connect it to the word?
I have no knowledge about the Gestalt theory and the link with the N170. The N170 has been found to be more generally involved for the object in which we are specialized experts. So we are experts in word processing also.
It's a discussion we can have.
I know, okay. And I have a last question, but to be honest, I think it is a linguist that asked this question, and I do not understand some words, so the vocabulary. In French, it is a difference between énonciation and énoncé. And I don't know the difference between the two.
The enunciation is the here and now context of what is said. And énoncé is what is said, is the situation, the time and space of the story which is told, or of what is said. So there's no... It's possible that both matches, because we are here and now looking at screen, speaking, and we can talk about this, but most of the time we talk about spaces and times which differ from the here and now time and space.
So okay? Can we relate that to a change in perspective?
Yeah. Of course, yeah. And the question was, you said that direct eye gaze provide emotion more than averted eye gaze.
Yeah.
And in sign language, somebody can sign with averted eye gaze, but within a projection in another time and space. And so this averted eye gaze is direct in his own projected situation, and can provide emotion because it's towards somebody, an imaginary someone, you understand? Mm-hmm. So in that case, there is an interpretation that should happen about direct eye gaze in a projected situation.
Okay. But I agree. I try, maybe I did not insist enough, but this dichotomy between direct gaze is emotional and averted gaze is special, is a too simplistic view, which is often reported in the article, but it's too much simplistic. And in fact, so I try to demonstrate that as a function of the context, the mechanisms involved differ, and probably you're right in some cases, in some contexts, averted gaze can be emotional, of course. Yeah. But in that case, you said that it could be emotional because in the perspective you take, it is a direct gaze. Yeah, but I think a vertical gaze may be emotional, even if it's not interpreted as a direct gaze.
I find into one of the many interesting things of your presentation is the sort of default social interpretation of eye gaze, which seems to be sort of traced back, even in infancy, considering that your first the experiments with children also show that eye gaze is the first thing that gets significant results, and then all the other aspects are bootstrapped by eye gaze. So the question for me is, so is this default interpretation, social interpretation of eye gaze sort of genetically encoded, or is it the result of an emergent mechanism? And to what extent, for example, in the case of sign language, where the use of eye gaze from experience may be intrinsically different, can somehow compete, or what would be your expectation in terms of establishing the default when there is another competitor, which is, for example, in terms of frequency, as powerful as social gaze? I mean, we have some sort of social gaze and linguistic gaze for sign language, and they are both more or less equally relevant in the life of signers. So I'm wondering whether this is an emergent, configuration of our brain, whether it's sort of genetically.
I think it's always an interaction between the two, but there are evidence that we have a brain module or neurons innate neurons that respond to direct gaze in newborns. So I don't know whether the newborns probably does not interpret this stimulus as social. It means probably nothing for the newborn, but this neuron specifically responds to this stimulus. So something has been developed by evolution in the brain. After that, the fact is that the processing of nonverbal cues, emerge before language. So in that way, they may have more, maybe play a greater part in the default mode network, maybe. But there are no study on the question for now.
So I think that one possible way to analyze this, for example, would be to look into the behavior of deaf signer and track the the meaning of direct gaze, whether they are interfacing with hearing as opposed to signers. So you would predict in one case sort of selectively going for the social interpretation, in the other one have a bias towards the linguistic interpretation of direct gaze, possibly. Thank you.
Thank you.
So in order of appearance, so do you use such term as cognitive or covert simulation of action and perception, or performative or overt simulation of action and perception, to describe inner mimicry and mimicry and expressive mimicry? No, I do not use such term as cognitive simulation and performative simulation. And honestly, I don't really know what can be a cognitive simulation. A motor simulation, I can easily imagine, but as purely cognitive simulation, I don't know what it could be. And also, inner mimicry, I'm not sure, but maybe it should be, maybe the author of this question could clarify it in order to help me to answer. Also, for inner mimicry, I'm not sure to understand what you're talking about. Are you referring to such things as mirroring processes?
I think I react to one of your first slides when you talk about A mimicry effect? You said something.
On emotional contagion. That's your.
What was
you
it?
Have. Yeah. Motor contagion on the other's face.
I was wondering whether the mimicry was something that was only internal, so something about the brain activating, as studies on mirror neurons had shown, or if you were talking about mimicry in gestures, so something more external, or something not only... not only in the brain, but it's wrong, because when the brain activates, there is also... I'm not sure of this, but I think there is a une décharge. Mm-hmm. How do you call this? There is something falling down in the entire body. And this is what is called Pulvermüller, for example. And it's also it's to be linked with the man. it's Antoine or Alexandre. Alison talked about the fact that sensory motor mapping was done in the brain. And so this is with the neuron mirror, the mirror mapping of the brain, you have this activation that can be done with that action and which anchor in action and perception networks, neural networks. So, and as you can have this activation, this simulated activation is called cognitive one by Pulvermüller, for example. And as I work on sign language and gestures and mime, I was interested in performative simulation. And also, yeah, Irène talked about simulation. And there is also a very interesting article by Ostetter and Alibali talking about the fact that you can the overt simulation, overt activation, can become covert when there is a threshold is open, and so what is all inside come outside in gestures. So okay. I was wondering whether you know all those terms.
Okay. In the studies I discussed, it was clearly what you called overt simulation that is recorded classically with electromyography on the muscles on the face and things like this. And it's there's people who will argue that there's also covert simulation, but honestly, I'm extremely skeptical about the mirror neuron theory of empathy and things like this. I do not buy it, and I'm not even sure there's mirror neuron that's mirrored. The idea is extremely simple and sexy, so it spread a lot. But I'm pretty sure that all the people who spread it a lot didn't read paper related to mirror neurons from the past 15 years. And honestly, today, I had the occasion to add a roundtable about mirror neuron several months ago with person working on it, like Ferrari. I don't know if you know his word. He's one of the major on the field, and I was telling him that it will not be ecological at all to mirror my congener all the time, because if I'm throwing my key to you and you're primed with this movement, you will never catch. With this movement, you will never catch my key. Or most, if not all, of four behavior are socially directed. If I'm angry against you, you don't have to be angry against me. You have to be scared and try to escape. And there's only a very limited proportion of all behavior that needs a reaction in mirror. So, I'm not sure there's a lot of evidence that could support the covert imitation for emotion and for empathy. The study I was referring to concerned covert imitation. But yes, we should all be extremely cautious, make great caution when we speak about mirror neurons. We are not even sure they mirror. They react when we see others move. But we have mirror neurons in our parietal lobe, in our temporal lobe. I'm not sure they're motor. I'm quite even sure they're not.
After reading Wandering, I'm not. I don't know cognitive. I have never practiced such electro, etc. Yeah. But I understood that they are not. The mirror, the image of the mirror, is used to describe a way of activation. So the neurons are not himself. I don't know what is wrong with this image for you, but I thought it made sense to think about neurons devoted to precise action that activated if the action is not done for real. So something linked with abstraction and symbolicism and projection, creating a virtuality and dealing with distance, empathy, emotion, receiving things. So more a way to activate rather than neurons that are essentially specific to dedicated to mirror things. Is it clear?
I'm not sure, but don't hesitate to interfere if I not understand your purpose. But just to be clear, I'm not denying that mirror could have a covert activity. Not at all. Most of them do. Yeah. I'm just inviting to a lot of caution when discussing about mirror neuron. Where you can have activation of a same motor neuron for two actions that are not the same. For example, like this or this. They are not the same at all. In one case, you grasp, in the other case, you extend your finger, and the same mirror, same neurons, not even sure it's mirror, the same neurons react for two different actions. Other mirror neurons react whatever you're doing with your hand. So it's just hand neurons. Whatever another person is doing with his hand, you just see it, and is the hand, okay, the mirror is active. I'm not sure we can learn anything by...
Maybe I find that often conversations go into this mirror neuron business, and if we can maybe change topic. Okay. I mean, we have other questions, I think, so maybe we can... Sorry, I'm just that I'm familiar with this conversation and it's never ending.
I was also intrigued by this finding that recognition of emotion is somehow blocked when the person cannot articulate. But I was not thinking about mirror neurons. So, as have you. Okay. I was thinking. I mean, why should it be so? So I thought, well, maybe it's because
closer to the micro.
Okay. So why should it be so? And I was thinking about. Maybe what helps is a proprioceptive perception, so or what by the person. So, but then signers might be should be different in this respect, because signers do not have the same proprioceptive perception of what they are doing, because they cannot see their face. Okay, so. So signers, in principle, are very can recognize emotions very well. Mm-hmm. Okay, but if the factor that makes recognition of emotion easier is a proprioceptive perception. The better performance by signers should not be immediately explained, because while when we speak we can hear ourselves speaking, mm-hmm. okay, and this is important in spoken language. In sign language this does not happen, because when someone signs cannot see or cannot properly see his entire body, his the face, the facial expressions. So it's just a speculation. I mean, I'm not offering anything. But I said, well, maybe what advantages is this fact that if you can articulate, you have input from your own body, which is consistent with the emotions that you are recognizing. But maybe this is not enough, or it's not the right explanation. So still, so what is the source? Mirror neurons are not an explanation. We agree on that. But what is the source? So why should be able to simulate even internally the facial expression of emotion help recognition?
Yeah, the idea is that because you cannot refrain from activate the same motor pattern as the one you are looking at, you experience at the first person perspective a kind of motor activation that is usually activated when you feel joy, for example, or I don't know, fear, and because you at a minimal level experience that emotion, you can attribute the emotion to the other person. That's the classical interpretation. And I'm not sure that signers will be better than control participants, because we all express our emotions and we all live at the first person perspective the emotion in the same way. Even blind person, congenital blind person, naturally express fear with faces who look like the faces I've shown to you some minutes ago. And that works for a loss of emotion. What changes, for example, for blind person, is when you ask them to explicitly, you ask to a blind person, okay, show me the fear. And then the face is not typically of what is classically fear. But we all, emotions are designed, constructed by evolutions and natural selection. Then we all express them in the same way, because it provides an advantage. And then, yeah, at the first person perspective, I believe signers and non-signers all live emotions in the same way.
We recognize our emotions of happiness or anger or whatever by having awareness of our own internal facial movement, or okay, so we don't need to look to.
Yeah, okay. In fact, there's authors, and it's an important theory that postulates that it's during the infancy. That the infancy, like for a really young baby, you synchronize because we mimic each other. And I feel a particular emotion. I see the face of my mother or father with the same motor activation. And I synchronize. And I know that when I'm in that state, that's the type of face that I can see because he's mimicking me.
Right, when we're talking about mirrors and neurons, okay, I just wanted to go back a bit. The cortex, there's a motor cortex, but also there's a premotor cortex, yeah? And so we can see, witness an action, but we have also within the potential for that action. We know it's not like mimicry, but the potential, the potential, the potential. And like when we say, if someone's happy, I have the potentiality of being, of feeling and showing that happiness on my face. And it's in the relationship, you know, if we're close or if we are disconnected, as all humans, there's a great variety and degrees of being connected to someone. Okay, I'm just losing myself. I don't know my question anymore. Oh, yeah. So when we're talking about the mirror, in your comment, like, if you're going to throw something, we're not going to mirror you and copying you, and the reaction is going to more, oh, how can I protect myself from being hit by whatever you're throwing? But if there is a feeling of empathy with what somebody's saying or what somebody is doing, the mental representation that we have of what we feel, if we feel a strong connection, we can actually, it can activate mirroring or mimicry. Like, for example, you know, if there's a film, an eventful film where there's a lot of things happening, someone escaping and all that, and we participate in that emotion, we can actually mirror. When you say mirroring is not possible, I think maybe we need to distinguish, actually, the motivation, you know, like if we're being challenged or if we are feeling closer, if we are building a rapport with the interlocutor. Okay, just dropping a thought here.
I'm not even sure it was a question. I agree that social context, link between participants, more comments, it modulates the activity, of course. But you've pointed something that I like to discuss, because we always saying that we mirror the mental states of others in the mirror neuron theory and things like this. And in fact, typically, when you're looking at a movie, the other person is an actor which does not suffer, is not really happy, is not really sad, he's just pretending. You're not mirroring his mental states. You're projecting your interpretation of your feedback into his states. In fact, you're projecting, not mirroring, in those situations because you believe at the first-person perspective a motor experience that classically evokes you a typical emotion. But that's not his mental states or her mental states that you're mirroring. You're projecting your own. One point against the mirror systems, the mirror neurons theory of empathy again. So thank you. I missed this one.
Sorry to go back on the mirroring thing, but I'm thinking it's already what you're doing, but we should not establish a distinction between the different registers or communication situation, and I think there's a special case to be made for aesthetic experiences, actually, and when aesthetic experiences, what I was talking about this morning, and when storytelling basically is involved. And I was thinking about my own experience as a mother when I read stories, basic stories to my youngest child who's four, and for 2 years now I cannot observe him, mimic him as I tell a story and take on a voice or mimic myself an emotion that is being portrayed by the characters in the story, that my son is mirroring those facial expression. I can't call that, right? But this is more enhanced when it's taking place within a storytelling situation, it seems. And it will be the same in a theatrical event or the same as we're talking about watching a film. Like this experience that we've probably always had, that if we see a show that is very highly kinesthetic, with high energy, very virtuosic, whether that's circus or, you know, highly physical, where we feel we're a bit on the edge of our seats and or we feel our body's tense, etc. But I'm wondering if it's specific to that type of situation where an aesthetic experience is involved and maybe in connection with storytelling and interpretation, really. That this tendency that we have as interlocutors to mimic facially or in our body the emotions that we are seeing conveyed by others are not enhanced or illuminated or intensified in situations that are connected to an aesthetic experience.
Yeah, I don't know anything about aesthetic experience, but yeah, it's clear, as it was said, it is clear that under some circumstances we mimic more. There's a lot, the social bond play a role, the emotional context, the social context, a lot of factors can modulate those reactions. But the, we always imitate, mimic each other. That's the by default. It is even strange when someone counter mimic you or voluntarily suppress mimicry. You immediately feel in comfort with this person.
I'm fascinated about the data that you show on left neglect and the change of perspective as a sort of mitigation. Of mitigating the effect. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering whether you know anything about those communities where they do not use individual reference systems or relative reference systems, but they use absolute reference systems. So, for example, Australian communities or Mayan communities. So, and these individuals do not perceive space around them has organized with respect to their own perspective, but they use a system of reference that it's absolute, typically based on the position of the sun or position of particular big entities in the environment, or even the absolute measures like north, south, east, and west. So do you know anything about left neglect in these particular populations?
Not at all.
or do you have particular expectations?
I'm afraid of saying things that I could regret because I don't think at all. That's the first time I'm wondering about it.
Because there is clearly something has to be there, right?
Yeah. The damage, but I would. No, but my response could change in the following days. But no, right now. I would say that they should show the same impairments on all the real tasks. When you ask them to, find all the stars on a paper, or to shave their faces, or to find all the post-its that you've pasted on their arms and things like this. But what it can change is when you ask them to imagine. A classical test is to ask patients, okay, imagine you're in Marseille, you're looking the north, and now tell us all the city that you can name in France. And classically, people omit the left, the city from the east in that condition. And then you change, you say, okay, imagine you're in Lille, you look at the Mediterranean Sea, and then in that condition, they omit all the west city. Maybe on that type of task, which refer to more abstract things, to more imagined realities, we could observe a difference. But they have no reason to not explore the environment the same way, because we all act thousands of times per day with all arms in all reachable space, not with the mountain or the horizon.
With respect to the Mayan population, at least, it's a big debate whether they don't perceive the same
also
way.
Relational.
They don't express it the same way. It's a Levinson, a big Gleitman. Gleitman-Levinson debate in the literature, but there is the evidence from emerging sign language from Nicaragua in a different orientation task, that first-generation signers that did not have the words for left and right failed on a spelky kind of orientation task that requires this concept, which is totally nonverbal. Second-generation signers And even the same signers, after they've learned this concept left and right, the lexical items left and right, did not fail on this totally nonverbal task. So I think there's interesting. It's not that obvious. It's a really interesting question.
I was provoking. That's of course.